Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Okay, I got to warn you guys right off the bat. This is going to get an explicit rating on iTunes. The book is Sinking in the Swamp, How Trump's Minions and Misfits Poisoned Washington. And the authors join us in the Bulwark studio. Thanks for coming in. Lachlan Marquet and Aswin Subsang. Did I get that even close to right?
You got both of them terrifically right. And this is Aswin. Thanks so much for having us.
Aswin, we're going to call you Swin from now on. So
I
got the thing. So the author description in the book, identifies you as investigative and White House reporters for the Daily Beast. NPR has compared the unlikely duo to Bert and Ernie. Trump acolyte Sebastian Gorka has accused one of them of having a cocaine habit and the other of having no moral center. So which one of you has no moral center?
Swin.
Yeah, Swin has no moral center. Lachlan has the cocaine habit, allegedly.
Okay, that's good. There's no way to do this without doing the explicit rating.
Don't do drugs, kids.
First chapter of this book is titled Another Shitstorm in Fucktown. Okay, I wanted to get that up, so because if you're not going to be able to handle it, you might as well bail on the podcast right away. We do them every day. You can come back. So, okay, first of all, how do you get the publisher to let you use that title? Another Shitstorm in Fucktown.
It's unfortunately just the title of one chapter, and that was sort of a light compromise on our part, because when we were talking about this book in its inception with the publisher, Swin, was emphatic that I thought the only appropriate title, at least in my eyes, for this book would be, quote, Another Shitstorm in Fucktown, colon, The Donald J. Trump Odyssey, or something like that. But I very much wanted it to be a title in the spirit of that. And our book agents and folks, the fine folks at our publisher at Penguin Random House, gently informed me and Lachlan repeatedly that, well, to do so at the very least would help kill book sales, probably, because it's hard to market a book like that in your Walmart or your Kmarts or on fine bookstore shelves everywhere, especially if you have kids walking by.
I do not want to break this to you guys, but one of the biggest bestsellers in America is The Fine Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is right?
Wow. So, when we wrote the first draft for this book, we basically divvied up the chapters initially. So Swin took half the chapters, I took half the chapters. And if you know us, despite having spent now 3 years collaborating on a lot of stories, our writing styles are very different. I had to call quite a bit of profanity out of the final draft. But in that initial draft, our chapters were like, it was like night and day. They looked very different. And I remember reading over the draft and I'm thinking, We can't turn this in. Like, we can't give this to the publisher. There's no way they're going to publish this. Thinking, of course, about Swin's chapters in particular. Uh-huh. And so I thought, you know what? We'll give the draft to the publisher. They'll come back and they'll tell Swin, you need to dial it back a little bit. And then I won't have to be the bad guy in this situation. So we submit the draft. They come back a couple weeks later, and they love Swin's chapters, and they hate my chapters.
A little tension there.
Well, and I think they, like us, were really looking to, you know, part of the reason I think it works having that sort of over-the-top title of the introduction is it sort of slaps you in the face right off the bat and lets you know very clearly that this is not going to be your run-of-the-mill sort of insidery access journalism Trump book. It's not a Bob Woodward, narrative nonfiction piece. And I think that's something the publishers really understood from the get-go, was that with all these different Trump books coming out, this one had to be set apart in some way. And it very much fit with the character of its authors that way was to have that sort of irreverent freewheeling style.
So the subtitle is How Trump's Minions and Misfits Poisoned Washington. This is the account of Donald Trump's clown car of lieutenants and lackeys who have polluted the corridors of power with their unprecedented awfulness. And right on the cover, it's like, we're not going to insult your intelligence by pretending to play it down the middle, and we hope you're looking for a take on this ridiculous time in our country that doesn't try to pretend that everything is fine and normal. It isn't. I got to tell you guys that what I really love about the book is not only the irreverence, but the fact that you go right at this draining the swamp, because I live here in flyover country, one of the states that will actually determine the election, unlike where you guys are. and the cliche that just is just you can't throw a rock without some Trumpist saying, well, yeah, he may, you know, be doing terrible things, but at least he's draining the swamp. And it's like, you know, the words you use in the book are the words that I have to restrain myself from using. Okay, so obviously, since we teed it up at the beginning, what is the another shitstorm in Fucktown? What is that? What was the shitstorm?
Well, when Lachlan and I, sometime in 2017, first started covering the Trump World and White House beat together, we affectionately and not so affectionately started referring to that beat as the Trump White House Omnishambles beat, just because it didn't take a genius to figure out that from day one, Trump's West Wing was consumed with infighting, tumult, cruelty, backstabbing, and all kinds of, well, I mean, the cliche and the term of the era, I guess, was chaos. It was an obviously pornographically, violently chaotic time to be covering the ongoings of the president's inner circle and West Wing. So Lachlan and I will often talk about how the sort of crucible for us and what defined in our heads and hearts and minds to this day of covering Trump and his world started in May 2017, for real for us, with the firing, of course, of FBI Director James Comey, and then the Russia probe getting real, and all the other disaster and hoopla and controversy and scandal that spilled forth, not just in the months and years after that, but contained in that specific month of May 2017. Lachlan and I hadn't seen anything like it. We certainly hadn't covered anything like it. And at that point, we were assigned specifically to the Trump White House. Neither of us had covered a White House before. We were not Obama White House reporters. So it was a gigantic just cudgel to the forehead for us. And we were like, okay, obviously things are not normal. Like I said earlier, it does not take a genius to figure that out. The racist game show host is the leader of the free world now. But May 2017 is really when it crystallized to us, okay, we're in, it's just another shitstorm in Fucktown from now on. And that's,
and so, I mean, every day proceeding from that was, you know, usually it would start at around 5 p.m. And if you think back to that month, this was happening like every day. 5 p.m.
Burned
it was
into
like,
my consciousness.
Yeah. Right. There would be a Washington Post story or a New York Times story or an NBC story just, you know, like shifting the earth in Washington, just groundbreaking stuff. You know, we found ourselves chasing, you know, like Swin said, we hadn't really been covering the White House before. We were competing with some of the best reporters in the country. So we found ourselves sometimes sort of chasing these stories. And what that would entail very often was kind of getting on the ground reaction from folks in the White House and how they were trying to deal with the fallout from this like cascading series of controversies. And that sort of came to define our style of covering the White House was, you know, how is this being experienced on the ground by the people who were forced to deal with the tweets and the investigations, et cetera. So, I mean, it was just like nonstop every day,
like
more of that.
How it was crashing down so thoroughly and forcefully atop the heads of these pretty inexperienced apparatchiks. And obviously, we built out our reporting style and beat from the ground up from there, but that was sort of how we dove in head first into the muck of like Trump investigation and scandals in mid 2017, sort of starting from the worm's eye view of things.
So I have this kind of fantasy of you guys as young reporters sitting in the White House and you're talking about all of this, and one of you says to the others, I don't know, this seems a bit chaotic to me. And then the other one says, it seems very shambolic. And then, and then the other one, whichever one we're starting with, goes, yeah, it's really a shitstorm. And then you say, yes, it's not shambolic, it's Fucktown. I mean, this is the thing that I think is hard to get your head around. I don't think the historians are going to be able to capture what it was like living through that history. And there is something, even in the best news coverage, there is that sort of flattening and normalization of just what a freak show it was.
No, absolutely. And that's one of, in our daily coverage at the Daily Beast and with this book, that's one of the things we were trying to crack through. And I think we make these points pretty explicitly in the book itself, where, look, like the old rules, unfortunately, at least unfortunately for me and Lachlan, still apply for probably the vast majority of national political media covering Donald J. Trump and his orbit right now, which means that even for how ridiculous or corrupt or like outrageous or whatever adjective you want to throw in there, they are portraying him as rather accurately via their work, there's still this sort of sheen and veneer of the default dignity to the office that is being observed whether you pick up a copy of the Wall Street Journal or a copy of Woodward's latest Trump book. They're covering it as if you would an Obama White House or a Bush White House or Clinton or Carter or Reagan White House. Like, there's the same template. And I think that, personally for me, that default respectability of covering a president and the politeness that comes with it,
yeah,
I think is wrong, even if Obama or Bush or Clinton is in the White House. I think that's bad. I think media should be more nasty to these incredibly powerful people who make decisions that can have negative consequences for millions of people at home. And
okay, I'm going to ask you a question that I've asked some of the other authors who've dealt with this as well, because I'm somewhat obsessed with this question. You talk about all the, you know, the charlatans, the conspiracy theorists, the ideologues, these just run-of-the-mill con artists that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with. You know, how did that happen? How did Donald Trump become the magnet for all of these misfit toys? What is the dynamic that the worst people in the world that you would never hire to mow your lawn end up running the White House, at least for those first few months?
So I think there's a couple answers to that. The first is his particular style, sort of a paranoid populist style that inevitably attracts people of the ideological and dispositional stripe that you tend to see much more of in his White House than in prior White Houses. But there was also a sort of a practical inevitability of that, which was, if you think back to, say, late 2015, despite Donald Trump leading in virtually every poll in the Republican presidential primary at the time, he was still pretty toxic among most Republicans, especially most professional Republicans, the types of people who staff up and fill out these large apparatuses, that are presidential campaigns. And, he was offering, if I remember correctly, like extremely high, it was sort of like Bloombergian. We're seeing Bloomberg do a lot of this now, which is offering extremely high salaries. Just because he was sort of starved for top talent. But even then, you saw most of the Republican sort of political class gravitating more towards Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, et cetera. And then when the field starts winnowing, you have a lot of these people who are put in one of two situations. Either they can't bring themselves to work for Donald Trump, because they simply, feel that he's unfit, or they disagree with him politically, or whatever it is, or probably more often is because Donald Trump is so fixated on personal loyalty to himself, a lot of these people weren't able to get. If you had been tweeting up a storm about how horrendous and toxic Donald Trump was, that was not something that went unnoticed by the president's inner circle, and it significantly hampered your prospects in working for him in the future. And I had numerous friends and professional associates in the very early Trump administration who decided that they were going to bite the bullet, and they had been toiling away for 8 years under a Democratic president, and there was finally a Republican in the White House, and they had their misgivings and their disagreements, but they felt that they could do some good and they wanted to serve in the government, so they applied for a government job. And I know numerous people who couldn't get jobs, and in fact were in the latter stages of the whole process for securing these jobs, only to have it sort of deep-sixed at the last minute because some tweet turned up in which they were criticizing the president.
Yeah. And some of them were escorted from the building.
Right. And we actually write, there's a scene in the book where we just happened to be at a mutual acquaintance's party here in Washington. And there was a guy we know who worked for the White House at the time who was there. And another guy who worked on the Hill and was looking to maybe get in the administration of some form. And they start talking about, what this process would look like. And the White House guy is saying, now, have you tweeted about the president before? He said, well, yeah, you know, back, I think, around convention time, I tweeted some maybe not so nice things, but, you know, I deleted those long ago. And he's going, oh, we will find them. If they, you know, if they were out there, they will be found. So just be aware of that. So, you know, that's not a, effective staffing strategy, you know, when you're already starved for talent, to be sort of purging folks from the ranks who, you know, have dissented once years ago. So I think that plays a big part of it.
You guys probably know that I'm longtime friend of Ranked Priebus, who bizarrely ended up as the chief of staff after being the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And in those first few months, you had Bannon there, and you had Jared Kushner, and you had Reince Priebus, and it felt like everybody was leaking against everybody. So how did that dynamic work?
I mean, it was fantastic to be a reporter relying on leaks at the time. Well, I should say it was great, and it was also – so you obviously the number of people who would be willing to leak to you was fantastic. But as a reporter, there's an added you know, there has to be an added layer of skepticism because you're not sure why someone is leaking some particular thing to you.
Right. It was cross-referencing half a dozen or so different lies told from different angles. And then you kind of negotiate and are able to report and confirm the kernel of truth intersected and shown in the middle.
So you're like triangulating all the different, right. All the so, bullshit that you're being fed.
Exactly. So I mean, that applies to covering basically any administration if you look at it cynically enough. But it especially applies to something like the first year or first 3 years of the Trump White House.
Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, of course, when John Kelly came in and he was going to be the adult in the room and he was going to impose order. And of course, as we're chatting this week, John Kelly is now speaking out about all of his misgivings, and the president is tweeting up a storm about how he was in over his head. Basically, this was an unmanageable and remains an unmanageable White House, right? I mean,
I'm glad the
chaos and the shitstorm is fixed. It's baked in, right?
The fact that you use the phrase "adult in the room" is I'm glad you used that phrase, because when we initially started floating ideas for a book, and where, you know, when we had people sort of coming to us asking if we wanted to write something, one of the initial ideas that was floated was actually that I think that was the working title, was "The Adults in the Room," and it would be about your John Kellys and your H.R. McMasters and your Jim Mattises and your Rex Tillersons and the folks who were ostensibly, you know, keeping the train from flying off the rails. The problem is they weren't really keeping the train from flying off the rails. And, you know, the adults in the room have either, you know, been just completely ineffective or, you know, for whatever reason, unable to, like, keep this whole shit show on track. It was kind of anathema to the entire spirit of our White House reporting in even entertaining the idea that these people were having much of an effect. Okay, so that was an idea that was discarded pretty quickly.
Okay, so talk to me about Rudy Giuliani. You'd
best man at my wedding, Rudy Giuliani. Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, so he actually pranked you, Swin.
Okay. This is weird, and this shows up. I think
this is weird.
It shows up at the start of one of the chapters in our book that I think primarily focuses on the lawyers of Trump world. One of them, of course, being one of the president's personal attorneys, Rudolph Giuliani. And the scene takes place where I'm just minding my business, sitting at my in-laws' dinner table in Ohio shortly before Christmas 2018. So just completely out of the blue, apropos of nothing, I thought, my phone suddenly dings. And this is near the end of the day. I'm excited to get off of working remotely soon. And I look at it, and it's Rudy Giuliani texting me. And it, just unprompted, he starts texting me about how he's stuck on a plane on the tarmac, and he thinks it's some sort of hostage situation or something like that. And he's trying to liberate the plane, and he thinks Bob Mueller is doing this to him and trying to squeeze him, but I'm no rat. And then he sends a little rat emoji.
I remember this, yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to snitch out Donald J. Trump for parking tickets he had in the 1970s near the Moscow embassy. Really weird hemorrhage and brain aneurysm sounding stuff. So I'm looking at this and I'm like, was he hacked, or did he leave a laptop open and his phone was synced to the laptop and someone who knows Rudy is like pranking reporters in his message contacts or something like that? So I message him back immediately being like, is this Rudy Giuliani? Are you pranking me? Are you fucking with me? Like, what's mm-hmm. going on here? And the person texting responds, no, this is a secret text. I'm telling you what's happening. I'm trying to liberate the plane. I'm trying to rope in like SDNY or the NYPD or somebody to help me. I have no idea what's going on. And I'm like, okay, maybe I should just ignore this. So I start just trying to walk away from my laptop and put my phone in my pocket. And suddenly it starts ringing. And it's Rudy Giuliani. I pick it up and it's very clearly him. And at first he's staying in character saying, well, Swin, I've liberated the plane. Everything's fine. And I'm like, are you drunk? Like what the hell is going on? And then he breaks character and starts laughing and reveals to me, it's like, okay, I'm just kidding. This has all been a ruse. I'm actually stuck on a tarmac, but it's just because the flight is delayed. And so he said he apparently pulled up 10 contacts in his phone, some of them journalists, some of them other Trump world people and friends or whatever, and just started basically texting them the exact same things, just the exact same bullshit fantasy scenario to see how they would react, just to see what they would do. He was wondering if any of the reporters, including myself, he was texting, would end up tweeting out what was going on to see if they would take it at face value. And basically, he was just trying to fool people and just kind of pull their leg and see what was going on. And after he revealed that to me, I kind of just stared blankly into the distance and just quietly thought to myself, the president's personal attorney, who is at the center of defending the president while he's trying to fight off this high-stakes Mueller investigation, this federal probe, is spending his time just before Christmas 2018 just randomly prank texting people while he's stuck on a tarmac.
Didn't it turn out that one of the people he was prank texting was Lev Parnas?
Yes!
Yeah.
It was later revealed that one of the 10 people who he wouldn't reveal to me who the others were who weren't named me was Lev fucking Parnas, and that was revealed because of all this tranche of text messages and documents that Lev ended up handing over to Capitol Hill Democrats
released. You had some of those the details of those cronies who turned out to be at the sort of the center of the impeachment saga. I mean, long before anybody else knew who they were, that was pretty good. So you also talk in the book about Giuliani talking about Michael Cohen getting raped and brutalized in prison. That's pretty nice. So what was the deal with you and Cliff Sims? Cliff Sims, a White House aide who wrote a book that I have to admit I didn't read, but you had some issue things.
Yeah, so the book actually opens with Swin almost getting into a fist fight with him in the lobby of the Trump Hotel. And that was
drunken fist fight.
Well, Swin was drunk. Sims is actually a teetotaler, so I don't think he had anything to drink.
See, this makes this book somewhat different than most of the other White House books.
Still counts as a drunken fist fight if half of the parties have been imbibed.
But it actually originated with a story we wrote. It was shortly after. It might have actually been in May 2017, that just horrendous month. Or it was, if not, it was shortly thereafter. You may remember at the time there was some reporting about the administration or the White House was going to create essentially a war room, a standalone like rapid response operation to deal with all this Russia stuff that just kept on coming. And that was initially reported by, I believe, Fox News and Politico. So we started making some calls to see if we could find out some more details. And the key detail that we found, and it was sort of the lead of a story we wrote, was that this Russia war room, as it was being called, would be led by or would involve heavily Cliff Sims, who at the time was director of message strategy, and Andy Sarabian, who was Bannon's top deputy in the White House. So we reported that. Within hours, Swin is getting a call from Sarabian, and I'm getting a call from Sims, railing on this story, total fake news, bullshit, you didn't wait for us to respond to your comment requests, et cetera. This was a Friday. It was after hours. So, we said, hey, if you want to call our editor, feel free. They never did. So we sort of let it lie. Subsequently, he got on pretty friendly terms with Sarabian, who's a very good guy, actually. And but Sims, we didn't speak to for a while until we're drinking one time at the Trump Hotel. It was actually right after James Comey's book party at the museum. Mm-hmm. And Sims saunters up to the table where we're enjoying some cocktails with some various Trump world people, and proceeds to get into it with Swin over this story. These guys, you know, decide they're going to stir the pot a little bit and bring it up, knowing that Sims still doesn't like this. Swin defends our honor by saying this was a 100% true story.
Which it was.
Which it was. Mm-hmm. Before long, these guys are like nose to nose, ready to go at it. Swin's refusing to shake his hand. Sims decides he doesn't want any part of this, and he starts to leave.
I'll take it from here.
Yeah, you go. Yeah.
Okay, so... Yeah, so we're screaming in each other's face, surrounded by other people there at the table in the lobby of Trump Hotel, including Lachlan. And at the time, Rick Grinnell, who was on the cusp of being confirmed as Trump's ambassador to Germany, was just randomly chilling there as well. So after screaming in each other's faces for a while, Cliff decides, okay, I've had enough of this. So he puts out his right hand to shake mine. And I repeatedly scream, I'm not shaking his fucking hand, because he just got in my face. It's like, you don't get to try to make nice. So he just says, okay, I'm out, throws up his hands and leaves. And as Sims is leaving, he's halfway through the lobby of Trump's DC hotel. He looks back at me and we make eye contact again. And I, being sort of drunk and not in the mood to not respond in kind, I start pacing after him, thinking, okay, if he wants to step outside, we'll step outside. So as I'm doing that, somebody puts his hand on my shoulder to stop. I turn around and I think I push him off me more forcefully than I thought I did. Security gets called and more yelling ensues. Cliff and his friend leave and are probably in their cab or Uber at this point. And Rick Grinnell is kind of sitting on the couch in the corner laughing about this, telling security, don't worry, it's fine, we got it under control. So after all of this, as Lachlan and I write in the book, the end result was like a lot of noise, a lot of yelling, but sort of emblematic of the Trump era, nothing really got done. And I just continued drinking at the Trump Hotel until it was time to leave. And by the time we got in the cab... and this was long before Lachlan and I were ever like writing a book together. Lachlan kind of turns to me and says, I think my new favorite memory of covering Trump world with you is you almost getting into a fist fight with a senior White House official in the lobby of Trump Hotel.
And if we ever write a book, we're going to include that.
That's literally what I said in the cab. And then soon enough, it turned out to be part of the lead of the book. So happily ever after.
Yeah, but you left out the fact that you tried to get Jim Comey to come drink with you.
Yes. So, before any of this happened, I'd been drinking, was a little tipsy at the museum during James Comey's party. He was not actually answering any questions in any real way. So if you were a journalist there trying to get the scoop and get him to talk about Trump or his time in the at the FBI in any meaningful way, it was not going to work. The guy was on script. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to wait in line with my book and see if he'll sign it in some weird way. And just ask him a pointless question just because I'm drunk and I want to have some fun with the guy. So big old, tall, towering Jim Comey, when he gets a hold of the book I ask him if he can sign it for Donald J. Trump. He obviously will not acquiesce to that. I ask if he can sign it for my parents, who are really looking forward to reading his book. He's nice enough to do that. I eventually give the copy to my mom and dad. So Lachlan's standing right there, and I just ask him, Mr. Comey, we're headed to the lobby of Trump Hotel. Would you like to come with us and do fireball shots with us? He laughs and politely declines, as, you know, is his wont. And Lachlan, literally face-palming in front of us, later takes me aside and says, Swin, I keep fucking telling you this. They do not serve fireball at Trump Hotel.
Okay, so I did not know that. Okay, so that's...
It's a classy joint.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, no fireball, but you spend...
They literally have $100 cocktails
for glass of Andre or something.
All right, so... I think we've established this is an unusual book. Which anecdote should we talk about next? I mean, so he was not a fan during the campaign. he was not a fan of Katie Turr.
Yeah.
Who wrote one of the first and really very entertaining books about
Trump. Yeah, we so when we did our first sort of serial, our excerpt from the book, we decided to, that, you know, some of the most outrageous stuff in there was really Donald Trump's treatment of and relationship with the press. I mean, media is just so inseparable from his appeal and his governing style, et cetera, that, you know, the president's obsession with what the press says about him and the particular personalities there are kind of, I mean, they're features of this White House like they haven't been in previous ones. So, you know, we looked at his colorful views on a few different media characters. In particular, I think my favorite scene was him essentially hitting on Abby Huntsman, like in front of her father, if I remember correctly, his now ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman.
Former.
No. But yeah, you know, he would just say really nasty things about, in particular, women in media. Katie Turr, whose father is trans, he called the bitch with the tranny dad. That was a pretty bad one. Making comments about Meghan McCain's weight, things like that. You know, we didn't want to just present these comments in themselves. I think what we drew from it is just the how, you know, it illustrates the president's unhealthy obsession with the things going on the little box in his living room.
Yeah, no kidding about it. But so, you know, remember Omarosa was out there implying that there were tapes somewhere of the president using the N-word, and I'm going to assume that if there were these tapes, we would have heard them by now, so that's BS. But you tell an interesting story about the reign of terror at The Apprentice, including the way he treated some of the African-American contestants.
Sure. That was actually mostly recapping reporting that I had done during the late stages of the 2016 cycle. Where I and a colleague of mine at the time, a reporter named Gideon Resnick, who now works for the Crooked Media Empire out west, we'd done a lot of digging on Trump's time at the Apprentice, particularly his behind-the-scenes machinations and behavior, and which included interviewing dozens upon dozens of current and former Apprentice World and Burnett World, Mark Burnett World employees. So the more people we talked to, the more tales and anecdotes we got of Donald J. Trump the man as he helmed and helped helm and reigned over The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice. And some of them, to us, really did paint a visceral portrait of what he would be like if you gave him the keys to the White House. I'll get to the most striking of those in a moment, but first I want to start with the thing I think you alluded to a moment ago, which was we'd heard from multiple sources with direct knowledge of this that when he was hosting Celebrity Apprentice and there was a season where the rapper Lil Jon was on the show, he was doing this sort of, you know, your listeners probably remember The Apprentice. They do these stupid fucking contests in public in New York City where they have to sell shit and sort of present a pseudo-fictionalized version of what they would be like running a business, and then Donald Trump tells you if you're fired or not. So this involved, for some reason, Lil Jon dressing up in an Uncle Sam outfit, you know, red, wine, blue, big old hat. And Trump sees this and just sort of tells the staff around him, look at him, he's an Uncle Tom. And the staff tells him, it's like, Mr. Trump, you mean Uncle Sam. That Uncle Tom is an offensive racial epithet. You shouldn't call black people that. And Trump, being the stubborn idiot that he was and is, says, no, the term is Uncle Tom, and keeps calling him fucking Uncle Tom. And it sets off this mini crisis on the set and behind the scenes at The Apprentice where people are calling other people, calling producers, frantically trying to get someone to get a hold of this guy to tell him, please stop using the term Uncle Tom. What are you doing? And I think it's entirely possible there was actually no racist, malicious intent here. He's just a stubborn idiot. who refused to concede that he was wrong.
And the same, I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes in the book, and I think the same sort of impulse was reflected there, is the meeting at the White House that Omarosa actually helped put together with Vietnam veterans, with veteran service organizations. And somehow the topic of Agent Orange comes up. Obviously, there's still a lot of veterans who are suffering from the aftermath of the use of Agent Orange in the war. It's a major issue, especially for Vietnam-specific veteran service organizations. When this comes up, Trump says something to the effect of, oh, yeah, the stuff from that movie. And it becomes clear pretty quickly that the movie he's referring to is Apocalypse Now, and the substance he's referring to is not Agent Orange, but is napalm, the famous Robert Duvall scene, you know, love napalm in the morning, et cetera. And a number of people in the room, you know, sort of try to politely interject and say, no, Mr. President, that was napalm, that wasn't Agent Orange. And he insists, he's like, no, I saw the movie, I know what I'm talking about, you know, it was napalm.
No, it was Agent Orange.
It was Agent Orange, sorry.
And he starts going around the room quizzing people, both guests and senior advisors, what the fuck it was in that movie. And finally, he gets around and makes eye contact again with a Vietnam War veteran, asks him, so was it napalm or Agent Orange? And this poor guy named Rick Weidman, who's, I believe, the head of this major Vietnam
Veterans of America.
I forget the official name of the organization. Whatever, doesn't matter. The head of this organization tells President Trump it was napalm. And he didn't say this, but one of the ways you know that is because the famous line in the fucking movie isn't, I love the smell of Agent Orange in the morning. And actually, I don't like the movie Apocalypse Now because I think it's a disservice to Vietnam War veterans. And Mr. Trump just says, well, I think you just didn't like the movie, before finally moving on. And him derailing this meeting for several minutes to just lecture these Vietnam veterans and these other veterans advocates in the rooms about a movie he just got dead wrong, manages to derail the meeting enough that by the end of it, they actually don't get to all of these different issues that they were supposed to discuss about war veterans. Again, some of them very much so life or death issues for veterans. And just to also broaden this out a little bit more, to show your listeners that this isn't just a story of Donald Trump being a goddamn moron, is that before he started getting into the Apocalypse Now debate with everybody else in the room, it started by advocates bringing up the issue of Agent Orange, and he just flippantly said, oh, that's been taken care of. And they had to remind the president that it hadn't been taken care of, and that the VA and the Trump administration and other administrations had not done everything that they needed to do to serve these underserved, suffering American veterans. So these aren't merely stories about antics and Donald Trump being kind of like a dipshit behind the scenes or whatever. There are stories about how that directly affects policies and people's lives. In this case, health care for people who put their lives on the line for or at least ostensibly for the United States and its well-being. Okay. So that's where we're at. That's what we got.
So Seb Gorka. Tell me about Seb Gorka. We started off with him. Seb Gorka, who apparently has issues with you guys.
The Dragon of Budapest. Yeah. So we actually started writing together at the Daily Beast. I think the first story we co-bylined was a Seb Gorka story. At the time, I was brought on at the Daily Beast in February 2017 as a White House reporter. But at the time, Swin wasn't officially on the beat. But I got this tip that the White House was basically trying to get rid of Gorka. He was, you know, ostensibly a senior national security advisor at the time, although it would later come out he was having some trouble with getting a clearance, and his background checks were turning up red flags. But we heard that they were looking basically for another agency to place him in, to get him out of the West Wing. We wrote that story. He wasn't pleased about it. And it became sort of two or three stories, I think, maybe even four stories about sort of the travails of the Gorka era. And, you know, each subsequent story made him more mad at us. He never, you know, responded to requests for comment in anything approaching like a productive or insightful way.
He is to me like the classic misfit and how that man got into the White House. And as you described, basically, Trump just loved him on TV. But he
loved him on TV.
TV. Right?
And, you know, so say what you will about Sebastian Gorka, but the man he's a very charismatic person.
I'm not sure if that's the word I would use.
It's 100% the word I would use. He's great on TV. He's great on radio. He's got a great voice for radio. He's got this whole sort of international man of mystery, like bad boy persona that he's built for himself. You know, everyone recognizes his ridiculous Ford Mustang with its Art of War license plates. So he's got like this whole persona, and it's just total catnip for Trump. Like the accent makes him sound smart and worldly, and he's talking about like the evils of, you know, Muslim people.
And the PBS show Arthur.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Actually what he did pretty recently.
I mean, you're right. He is like the quintessential misfit. He's also the quintessential, like he just embodies so many of these characteristics that will just endear you to Mr. Trump. So not just, you know, being good on TV, but I mean, he's got like the full package when it comes to like checking every box that will just make the president love you. Chiefly, he's like undyingly loyal to the president. He'll never say a bad word about him, so...
So this is not all fun and games. You know, I had to get to this because, like, I'm trying to think about how you do interviews with, say, NPR, or how you're going to handle C-SPAN. We can't use the language. Because, you know, we have these, you know, your subtitle is how Trump's Minions and Misfits Poisoned Washington. So I guess I want to sort of wrap up, like, you know, in the end, this is consequential. This is not just a series of, you know, bizarre anecdotes about bizarre people. In a moronic president, that there are real consequences. And I guess this is the disconnect of the folks in places like Wisconsin who think that, yeah, he may tweet silly stuff, but he's draining the swamp and getting things done. So what is the gravamon of this book? What is the serious takeaway you want people to have?
I mean, one thing that we say pretty explicitly and flatly in the book, at least a couple of times, is that, yes, we write it in sort of this darkly humorous, sort of wild, rompy kind of way, but we definitely do not want any readers of it to mistake that for numbness or nihilism towards the era. Like, professionally, as political reporters, the humor that we bring to our style of writing is sort of, at least in part, a form of personal Novocaine. At least I know it is.
It's a coping.
For me,
it's how do you cope with the insanity without just screaming into the night?
Right. And beyond the corruption or the breakdown of the rule of law stuff that the Washington Press covers very mightily in the Trump era, there is, of course, the human cost and the human toll, and to families and to immigrants and numerous other individuals and groups that this president and this presidency has had on people at home and abroad. And I mean, there's a lot of great reporters who are doing policy work on that, particularly on immigration, who reveal day in and day out the cruelty that this administration is trying to codify and enshrine in so many different ways when it comes to policy. And that is not the type of work we were doing with this book. We were trying to reveal something else about the Trump era. But
if I may,
jump in.
I mean, I think that, you know, what should really trouble Americans about like the way that Washington works right now is the sort of the impulses by which policy is made. So it's not a policy book in that it examines like the minutiae and the effects of specific policies, but it does. I mean, what we hope it does, at least, is show readers how Trump and the people around him tick and how they arrive at the decisions they do. And I think that is, you know, it's broader than any one specific policy, because basically, I mean, it sort of poisons the well for whatever comes out of the White House. You know, if you're taking your policy cues from a cable news host, that in itself should be extremely troubling. You know, you may have certain views on certain policies that result from that, but I mean, it's really a breakdown of the the levers of power and the mechanisms by which these incredibly important decisions are made.
You guys surprised that Hope Hicks is going back to the White House?
Actually, very. We were talking about this earlier today. I did not I thought maybe she'd come back if the president got reelected, but I did not expect to see her back in this term. I don't know about you, Swin, but...
Well, when she... Around the time she initially departed the White House a couple of years ago, people who were close to her had told me for a story I was working on at the time that she had told them flat out, I would not entertain a return to the Trump administration, at least for a full year after I'm gone, and likely multiple years if I can help it or whatever. And at the time when I put that in my story, I was like, okay, that sort of sounds like in private conversation she's hedging her bets to her friends or whatever. I did not think she would actually return for like a senior White House post. And you know what? She stuck to her word. It's been a couple of years at this point.
Yeah.
So she didn't return a year after departing. She privately said she wanted it to at least be multiple years. 2 years is multiple. Now she's back. So
the president, of
I
course,
guess there you go.
He's very much, there's a lot of momentum behind the president right now after, acquittal, the, disaster in Iowa for Democrats. The poll numbers are looking pretty good for him. The economy's chugging along. I'm not surprised that this announcement didn't come 2 weeks earlier. I have to imagine, she didn't want to, insert herself into the sort of chaos that was enveloping the place,
Right, because
very recently.
She left under a cloud of being pulled into multiple high-profile scandals
of
the
administration. Which is not cheap. She had to deal with, significant legal bills as a result of it.
Now a post-acquittal universe, I guess, the return of Hope Hicks in season 4, if we're reducing this to reality TV again.
I was about to say something that I didn't actually mean, because she actually seems to be, most people seem to like her. She had gotten out with her reputation reasonably intact. She had done well professionally. So when I was about to say the rats are going back to the ship, it might tell you something, but I didn't want to imply she was a rat. Gentlemen, this is one of the most entertaining books, if not the most entertaining book. A lot of these books about Trump tell us things that we already know about Trump. This is about this weird world and the folks that inhabit it, which I think is, I know it's overused, but it is the Star Wars bar scene. I'm convinced that cultural reference is already obsolete. So people are going to say it's like the Trump White House. The Trump White House will become the new Star Wars bar scene, and your book contributes to that. So anyway, Lachlan Marquet and Aswin Subsang. Did I get the names right again?
Subsang, but I'll take Subsang. It. I'll take it.
Subsang, Swin. This is why you went with Swin.
Yes, exactly. Like Cher.
The book is Sinking in the Swamp, How Trump's Minions and Misfits Poisoned Washington. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.
Anytime.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.